Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Just a couple of housekeeping items first. Please, everybody turn off your phones now. If everybody checks at the same time, nobody should be embarrassed to check now, but you should be embarrassed if they go off later. Second of all, we have another lunch coming up next week. Regina Ip, famous as the former Secretary of Security 8 years ago, more recently the leader of increasingly visible political party or political organization, and she'll be talking about political parties and their prospect for development in Hong Kong. With that, I'd like to introduce Ambassador Mulford. Many of you have probably heard about him for years, know his bio, he spent 9 years running the Saudi Monetary Authority. He was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury who put together the Plaza Accord for revaluation of the yen in the mid-1980s. He was ambassador to India at the time they approved their big nuclear power pact with the United States. But I just learned a bit of history from him over lunch that I didn't know before. And that is that he worked in an ice house. And I cannot remember any of our private prior speakers who worked in an ice house. As many of you know, this building was the ice house of Hong Kong. And they used to bring cubic yard blocks of ice here from northern China, Japan, Korea, even Kamchatka, after this building was built in 1917. And they would, you'd come and get your ice for your ice box before refrigeration. But he actually worked in an ice house as a boy in Wisconsin. So I'd like to introduce today's ice house worker, Ambassador Mulford.
Thank you, Keith, very much. Good afternoon, everybody. First of all, let me just say what a great pleasure it is for me to be back here again. This is a place I've been a couple of times in the past and had the opportunity, the privilege really, of speaking to you. And in this occasion, I was particularly keen to do this because I feel it's an appropriate time to review the 08 crisis in one sense as we see it today. And let me just make that a little clearer. As one looks at past events over the last year or so, one is struck by the rapidity of major events that have taken place around the world. The European problem, the Euro crisis, the Japanese earthquake, the sweeping revolts in the Middle East, all of which are major events, all of which have global fallout of one kind or another, all of which affect markets. But among the events of the past 3 years, in my opinion, the 08 crisis is the most global and the crisis of most lasting importance because of the long-term impact that it can and I think will have on our world. And I want to just reflect on that for a few minutes today and then open up to questions on really any subjects that you care to raise. The reason that the 08 crisis meets this test of importance, and I have linked this in the title today of Emerging Markets and Responsibility for Leadership, is that now, 3 years later, one can look back and one can make an assessment of what the 08 crisis might begin to mean as we look into the future. First of all, there's countless books on the subject of where it came from, what caused it, what the fallout has been, and so on. That's not my area of focus. In its simplest form, to me, the crisis was a crisis in the Western or developed country financial system, which nearly brought the world to a stop at the time, but also revealed something of a modern miracle in the sense that the developing world, for the first time, was able to sustain growth through that period. Now, obviously, they suffered a shock, an external shock. They responded to that shock, in many cases, with orthodox economic policies. But what is significant is that within a period of months, in major countries, China and India particularly, but also many other emerging market countries, growth was restored. And one can say that something like 50% of the world or more did not live in countries where there was a banking crisis or a crisis of confidence. And we can see how long it takes for countries to recover from those kind of events. And perhaps most surprisingly, apart from recreating in a matter of 4, 5, 6 months a significant sustained growth, these countries were also able to attract capital. And the popular thinking at the time was that the Western banking system would choke cross-border flows off to these countries, which of course didn't happen. And some countries have attracted capital so successfully they have more of it than they would like at the moment. So you look at that, and it, to me at least, it is a modern miracle, because I've had a very long career, all of it in one way or another linked to the rise of the global economy and global financial markets. As a private practitioner, as a government person in the Treasury, and even in the diplomatic area. And what is really impressive here is that these countries have managed, for the first time in every previous crisis I can think of that I was exposed to, big or small, the developing world was at the bottom of the pile, suffering the most onerous consequences of these kinds of developments. So here we have a situation that is completely different. And this really sets the stage, especially now that we can see with a bit of perspective, for some very, very significant challenges to the world as we have known it up till now. Now, I'd like to illustrate my point, my next point, by telling you just a brief story about what happened at the time that I was appointed ambassador to India. About 2 weeks after the announcement, I was up in New York and I saw Henry Kissinger. And I said to him, "Henry, do you think I've done the right thing to accept this job?" He said, "Oh yes, of course, without a doubt, and there's three reasons for that. The first is," he said, "India is such a complicated place, so diverse, so challenging, that for the first 18 months, your learning curve will look something like that. Secondly," he said, "as a result, it will be 2 years before you realize that you've made a mistake. And thirdly, there is nobody in the Department of State capable of writing more than one-third of the job description for India, so you will be more or less on your own." So job description, important concept just at the moment when you look at the kind of situation we've arrived at now. And I say that because if you look at the history of the rise of global markets, the institutional history, you go back to the end of the Second World War when the world was in a sense recreating itself and was launching new global institutions. And if you had asked political leaders at that time to write a paragraph or two of their objectives, every one of them would have had words in it to the effect that we have to more broadly spread freedom and prosperity in some form or another. And those institutions were designed to be the pillars of that new system, the IMF, the World Bank, other international institutions that came along. And they have served us well in many ways. But today, in the kind of multipolar world we have, with all sorts of new arrivals on the scene, we see a situation where these institutions are significantly out of date and unable to reform themselves quickly enough to keep up with the current changes that we see. We also see that the countries themselves, and this is something that you do every single day, are posing, if you look at the spread in growth that has been created now over this period between the developed world recovering very, very slowly and the emerging market world with a very sharp growth line. That space of differential, if extended into the future, as it already has been now for several years and is likely to for several more years, that represents the area of the transformation of power relationships in the world. And you record and write about these things each day and document them and see them in small bits. But if you step back and you ask yourself, what is going to be the long-term impact of this shift in power relationships, you really begin to get the impression that we are moving into a new world with very much higher risk of accidents or disagreements or stresses and tensions, pushing us back into an older world, a sort of world of the what might call the state of nature with not appropriate order, cooperation, etc. So that's those are the stakes, and I think it's something that people like yourselves should think about and hopefully will give consideration to during the course of your work, because there is such a scope there for uncertainty and challenges that need to be met. So that brings us back to the job description issue. What is the job today of the different players in the system? We came out of a system where, to the extent there was any sort of global economic and financial governance or cooperation or policy coordination, whatever you want to call it, of the type that we saw in the 1980s, and of the type we saw in the 70s, in fact, in the recycling of dollars in the petrodollar period, that was conducted by a very small number of players. And I actually was involved in the middle of that and came away with a feeling that in a room of more than 21 people, it would be very hard, G7, three people each, 21 people, it would be very hard to reach decisions that would be meaningful in terms of resolving problems. Now we see a completely different world. The G7 atrophied over time. It no longer is fully representative of the global economy that we live in. And instead, the G20 has been introduced. And the G20 is symbolically important because it is more accurately reflective of the world we live in. But operationally, it has yet to prove its ability to accomplish things. And when you talk about accomplishing things, you need to think about the kind of agenda that needs to be addressed today. The G20 has not been able effectively to address the big macroeconomic challenges that face us in terms of global imbalances, avoiding foreign exchange, tension, wars, possibly whatever people are worried about. And instead, it has had a much more a much less ambitious agenda. Such things as tax havens and corporate compensation and regulatory issues. In its early appearance at Pittsburgh and shortly after, there was a sort of immediate obsession with the need to create a regulatory structure that would be global and reach beyond sovereign boundaries, which of course is turning out to be impossible to achieve. So one has to ask, as you look at the situation today, what is the meaning of the word emerging? We should be perhaps more careful about how we use these words. We used to be using it in connection with the rise of emerging market countries, but many of these countries have now emerged, and they can't really be called emerging market countries anymore. But what about the United States? The United States is going to emerge again. Europe is going to emerge in some form over a period of years as it deals with its own internal problems and its economic and financial problems connected to the periphery countries. The Middle East countries are going to emerge. And Japan, after its earthquake and the tsunami, tragic as that was, will emerge in some significant way itself over the next few years. as a new economy, at least in my opinion it will. So that raises the question, how do we call together and encourage these sovereign nations of all kinds to begin the cooperative effort to make sure that our global economy has some degree of direction and governance about it, so that we do not face the kind of high-risk return to the past that could be, in fact, a global earthquake of enormous magnitude. Because consider, it took 40-plus years to build the kind of global market that faced the problems that we faced in 2008, and which are still being unwound in some cases. And were that to be reversed in the kind of world we live in, I think one doesn't have to have much imagination to see the degree of suffering that would bring about. So I just wanted to make those comments today before taking questions, because I feel that I have had a particular exposure to these things over the years. I have been a proud participant, in a way, in the rise of global markets. I think the fact that there was a crisis in 08 should not detract from the fact that over that period, we, the world, built a global financial system, not just financial markets, but freer trade, freer movement of people, freer movement of tradable goods, freer movement of technology, and that this has resulted in the lifting of prosperity and standards of living around the world to levels never seen before. So the question is, how do we keep that intact, correct the problems that we have suffered from in these recent years, and move forward in a way that recreates the sense of responsibility among all nations to step up and do their part in the processes that are necessary for successful economic policy. So thanks very much. I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you. Back here in the corner, please.
Hi, my name is Abhik Bhattacharya. I'm with the Wall Street Journal. I wanted to ask a question that draws more on your experience as ambassador of India than anything else. The U.S. over the last decade sort of helped India enter this comedy of nations through the Civil Nuclear Accord, or however you'd like to phrase it. That was perhaps, you know, definitely the peak of U.S.-India relations. And over the last month, for instance, you see a country like India taking a different position on airstrikes in Libya or the like. And I want to just perhaps broaden this and ask you, how does U.S. leadership, or lack thereof sometimes, affect how these emerging economies, or emerged economies, as you put it, participate in the international order?
Well, in many different ways, and it isn't just the, you know, at the ambassador's level, but it's a, you know, it's a comprehensive interface. And of course, among the leading countries, if you sort of just look back 3 years, there has been, first of all, a recognition of what I've tried to describe, and that has been factored, or is being factored, into the policy process. You know, the United States is in the position where it has to itself reflect on and accept that its model is less impressive or acceptable in the eyes of the world than it was, for reasons that have to do with the crisis that we had, that its own ability at leadership is perhaps somewhat reduced for the time being, and may be a permanent feature of the new system, and therefore require different kinds of leadership. These are hard things for countries to understand and absorb and then translate into their policy behavior. But in the case of India, the question you asked about the period that I was there, the United States had a very clear vision, and it was the vision of George W. Bush, basically, that, as he put it, a country of 1 billion people that was a successful, functioning democracy has to be important for the United States of America in the 21st century. And we sought ways to strengthen the strategic relationship, and among those ways was to address one of the constraints that India has, which is diversification of its energy base. The others are infrastructure on the one hand, and perhaps you could say rural economic transformation on the other, and all the related issues that fit those things. But the diversification of the energy base was something that lent itself to U.S.-India cooperation, because the United States held the key, as it were, to unlocking that. And it required a change in U.S. law, which had to be acted on by the Congress. It required a very long and difficult negotiation with the Indian government, first of all on a separation agreement, then on a working agreement for the nuclear cooperation, and then it required clearance through the IAEA and the Nuclear Suppliers Group, which had to be a perfect consensus of all 45 nations. So it was a massive enterprise. It took nearly 4 years. And that was based on being able to make that contribution. And of course, for India, as you may know better than I do, it was a very, very important event in terms of its own self-respect and returning as a sort of, or seeing itself as a sort of major player at the high table of economics and looking into the future, its own position and so on, after 35 years of isolation. So that is the sort of history of that agreement. But in each country, the nature of the challenge will be different. In the case of China, we obviously face, we the world face a situation in which there will be a change in the Chinese model, if you like, from what we've seen in the past to what we obviously are going to see in the future. And that is a process that other countries like the United States should be very much informed about, cooperative in, educate themselves about, and try to design their policies to reflect those transformations. And that is why, in a way, it's fair to say that this kind of work, you might just call it policy cooperation work, is extremely demanding, and it is not a part-time activity. It is something that needs to be engaged in full-time, and it needs to be understood and engaged in by heads of government, not just finance ministers.
Okay, next. While you think about it, why don't I toss in one here then. Mm-hmm. Brazil has worried of the potential for currency wars. The Chinese have been very critical of the United States on quantitative easing, even while their own, I guess, M2 has been going up a lot faster than the United States. Has the G20 failed to come up with a new framework for dealing with currency imbalances or currency and associated trade imbalances?
Well, I would say yes. The answer to that is yes. It's until now not really what I would call fully engaged in the problem of how, over the longer run, imbalances are going to be reduced or removed in the system. I would go back to the 80s once again, when we faced for the first time in the United States growing imbalances in the world system. And they were all-time record imbalances. Today they look small, but at that time they were very large. And the effect of the rising imbalances was that there was a very substantial move towards protectionism in the United States, and especially in the U.S. Congress. So the Treasury understood that if it couldn't make some progress in extending cooperation and changing the level of the dollar, that we might face in the omnibus trade bill some extremely onerous and punitive sort of arrangements. And so we started the process. Jim Baker was secretary, and that process led to the Plaza Accord and later to the Louvre Accord, and a 40% appreciation of the dollar from its peaks at that time. But importantly, it removed with Europe the imbalances by the end of that decade, and we launched at the same time the so-called yen-dollar talks with Japan, which were designed to open and help transform Japan and its use of its currency for trade and financial transactions, the openness of its market, access to its market by foreign players. And that negotiation went on for 8 years, and it was something we did two or three times a year. And that is what I mean when I say it takes an enormous amount of effort to do these things. And the G20 is very large. I mean, I think it's it's hard to think of how you actually accomplish these kinds of things when the scale of the participation is so great and the diversity among the players is so enormous in their terms of their interest, size, et cetera. So my own view on the G20 is that leadership will have to take the form of more bilateral contact and relations between the main players in the hope that they can begin to frame up positive policy responses to some of these problems that then the G20 can consider in an orderly way and decide whether they want to approve, like a board of directors, as it were. That seems to me to be the best hope, because otherwise you will not get the degree of engagement. And please remember that all this kind of work requires the creation of trust on both sides of the table. So, for example, between the United States and China on the currency issue, for many, many years, the United States has tended to raise the currency issue in public with the Chinese, which I think, frankly, is a mistake, because currencies are reflective of underlying economic fundamentals. And the way to address these problems is to address the underlying economic realities. That is one reason it's hard work. This means people have to become acquainted with each other. They have to build a trust. They have to share information. They have to stop talking past each other and talk to each other and truly engage. I believe it's possible. I've done it. I've seen it done. But today it really isn't happening. And this is one of the reasons that I think we are in a period of extremely high risk, because if we all we have is larger meetings that accomplish less, we will have publics increasingly unhappy with leadership and less to show for the efforts. So we really have to ask that the major players, even if they're fairly recent arrivals on the scene, are going to need to really focus on the question of what their responsibilities are to step up with the rest of the world to help find ways out of these impasses. And I think that's the best answer. Imperfect as it is, it's the only thing that really works among sovereign nations.
But just to follow up on that, you say that you need to address the economic inequalities. How would you do that? Are you talking cutting fiscal deficits, because that would reduce the output gap in the United States relative to demand? Well, that creates other problems. Some people, my colleague Paul Krugman, for example, suggests that the currency might actually be the least painful thing to adjust in this bilateral.
Well, I'm not saying you don't adjust the currency. I mean, you have a range of things that you can do. But one of the things the United States obviously has to do is address its fiscal problem. It must do that. It cannot work out of its present situation unless it does that. And everybody, I think, really sort of understands that, but the politics of getting it done, getting it started, and making real progress are very difficult. On the other hand, I feel encouraged in the United States by the fact, I say to people in foreign countries often, to understand the United States, you need to subscribe to 50 or 100 daily newspapers from towns all over America, because the battle on indebtedness is already engaged at state and local and municipal levels in the United States, and has been for the better part of 18 months or 2 years, because these are places where budgets by law must, for the most part, be balanced. And so the public in these cities and communities have already been confronted the reality of bigger class sizes, fewer police, fewer firemen, changes in the pension system, postponed projects. And these are things that the same people then turn around and see in Washington are not being addressed seriously by the Congress. And that, I think, accounts for some of the passion in the last election we had in November, which was very much a feeling that people were knocking themselves out facing this reality at the state and local level, and the federal level wasn't demonstrating a similar level of commitment. And I think over time this will spread. You probably followed to some extent what went on in Wisconsin in recent weeks in terms of legislation there that has transformed their fiscal situation and had certain implications for trade unions and so on. But that these are very, very important developments. So when you engage with countries, I mean, you really do have to get a full knowledge of the countries, and you have to create the impression that you understand their problem, and that that doesn't mean you have to sacrifice your own interests. It just means that you're going to be more effective if you can create the impression that you're there to understand and come up with ideas that work. Because we have common interests among countries today, and imbalances is one of them, and the bubbles that can come out of those things, the risks that people run if these things are not solved over time, currencies, whatever it happens to be, you know, these are things that really require a new level of engagement. And I think I'm struck by the fact that some very big countries, China, India, Brazil, and so on, have not so far really been ready to step up and provide leadership. Often, I think, because they don't see that they have an interest in doing so, because they know if they step up, they're going to have to begin to make transformations themselves internally. And there is a cost to that, obviously. But if you're going to be part of a global community and make that work, you really have to learn how to do that.
Okay. I don't mean to monopolize. Who would like to up here, please?
Sandy Hendry at Bloomberg. How would you analyze what's happened in the Middle East and the prospects that such political unrest might spread to somewhere like China, given the sort of disparate, I mean, emerging markets are getting more wealthy, but the gap between the rich and the poor has widened in many cases.
Well, I think the Middle East is a very special situation, has been for a very long time, and it is surprising in some ways that it's spreading as far and as quickly as it has within that region. I've said to people in recent weeks that if you had put the State Department together with the foreign ministries of all the major countries in Europe and given them $300 billion and said, please go out and change the Middle East, they couldn't have accomplished half of what's been accomplished by the people on the ground. So it is a truly, grassroots event. And I think the reality for the rest of the world is that we've passed a phase where the kind of leadership that has been in office in those countries is not there anymore for the most part, or will maybe soon not be. And we better be very careful about how we assess who we back and why, and let instead the developments flow up from the people, which those of us in democracies have had the faith of doing for quite a long time. And then instead of acting from the beginning that we can somehow or even should attempt to control this, I know there's risk in that, and everybody seems to know what that risk is. But I don't really see a way around recognizing and accepting the reality of these changes. I think the ability of this sort of revolt that's been taking place to travel is limited in other parts of the world for the time being, for a whole lot of reasons that are, you know, special to each country. In the case of China, they have their own pressures, but they are not, in that sense, strictly speaking, comparable. And I think they will not, in the near term, suffer the same kind of problems.
Over here, please.
Hi, this is Ken from Tom Group. Just a question. You were just talking about G20, but yeah, a lot of people right now are talking about G2, you know, the U.S. and China.
Yeah.
Do you think, you know, China is going to, like, drive, you know, a lot of this, the world global development for the next 20 years? And as if that's the case, but would it have the capability, you know, to affect a major change? And if that's the case, what will be the greatest risk for the next 20 years as the old order? You know, as the old order, how the world sort of worked together, the G7 or the previous world, as the old order is breaking down and the new order has not been established, everybody is like dancing around each other trying to figure out, right? Do you think mm-hmm. there's a big risk in the next 20 years? And the kind of risk you are seeing, would there be war? You know,
well,
with all this like conflict going on?
I think the risks in a way are multidimensional. and some of them are particular to countries and are politically explosive within those countries without being necessarily explosive or troublesome on a cross-border basis, except that they affect the sort of attitudes of those countries. So I wouldn't pick a single thing. I would say, however, that a G2, in my view, doesn't meet the challenge for the simple reason that the global economy is too complex. If you were to have a G2 and accomplish certain things, like, let's say, exchange rate movement in China, the surplus would move, it seems to me, to other places, and you wouldn't see the imbalance that people are focused on reduced very significantly between the two countries. So I think that you need to be talking one country to the other, but you need to be doing that simultaneously with a number of different countries. And ideally, if you can get to the point where 5, 6, or 7 of the largest countries are able to have a dialogue about these kinds of issues, which takes into account the better part of the global community, you have the chance, again, if you handle that right with your other club members, to head off and resolve some of the problems that could be very damaging, like trade wars or currency wars or political conflict that turns into real conflict at some point down the road. We're a long way from that at the moment. But I think what's the challenge that I'm addressing here, and I'm sorry to say I don't have, you know, a sort of magic answer, but I think it's an attitude of mind, is something that we need to get at. And it's important, it seems to me, for people who frame opinion the way you do from a key part of the world to focus on these, think about these things, and from time to time, you know, give some attention to them, because they are very, very important long-term issues. There's a financial conference going on here, the AIC is going on at the moment, and if you go and attend those meetings, you're struck by how the bulk of the participants are interested in very short-term issues. You know, where are the opportunities, where are the risks, now, next week, next month, etc. I'm not talking about that. All those things are important. I'm talking about the long-term architecture that we think we need to, in a way, not govern, but to provide the degree of governance in the world. Because I think that, you know, from time to time, that's necessary. You saw the return the other day of the G7 in the intervention business, for example, in the yen. Well, that was a very significant event. And in a way, it might have been better if it had been, you know, maybe the G7 decided to do it, but if they had used the G20 as the vehicle, maybe that would have lifted the credibility of the G20. But think of how complicated it would be to transform the cooperation of the 7 into something blessed or endorsed by the 20, many of them not being cooperative in the venture. But these matters of scale are very, very important. And if you're uncomfortable about having too small and exclusive a group deciding or mapping out strategies, then you have to find ways to expand the level of cooperation. But you must not give up the face-to-face dialogue that's necessary for success.
Okay, one last question here in the front. Just about out of time here.
David Lawrence, an associate member. When you talk about these G groups, the G7s and the G20s, don't they detract from what the real architecture of the United Nations? Why are we splintering our efforts through all these G groups?
I don't know that I can really answer that, except to give a personal opinion, which is that the United Nations is extremely large and not always very effective, and itself needs some degree of reform. So I don't think that's the ideal body, nor are the people who populate the body the kind of economic and financial people that you need to address these kinds of issues. Because it isn't just politics. There is some very real substance to the economic and financial issues, which have political implications, but there are some hard realities that need to be faced. So I think that you have to have these groups. A better question might be, why are finance ministers not given trade portfolios, for example, so that finance and trade are in the same department when it comes to dialogues between countries? Because notice that the trade dialogues, Doha Round and other things, they have developed a degree of specialization where you could even say they have a language all their own that sort of lay people don't always follow. And they have their own bureaucracies and so on, that maybe we'd be better off if these things were brought together, because trade is an essential part of the economic link between countries. So if you wanted to broaden out that way, that would make some sense. I think the UN is a bridge too far, if I could put it that way.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Mulford. I feel as though with your speaking in a former ice house located on Ice House Street, that we should have a former old rusty saw in a back room for you. We don't, but we do have something for you to remember the club
Thank
by.
Thank you very much.
Here you go.
Thank you. I might say that when you saw a piece of ice, it's roughly the same as sawing a piece of wood in the summer, but it just happens in winter.
Thank you all for coming.